Okay, I'll call this meeting to order of the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness for Tuesday, February 17th. To start with, I'm going to open a informational meeting on the Oregon Resilience Task Force recommendations to the legislature. And I believe Dr. Scott Ashford and Jay Raskin are going to present. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here. And if you'd just state your name for the record before you begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Ashford. I am Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University. And I am also the chair of the Governor's Task Force on Implementation of the Oregon Resilience Plan. I think it's timely that we're here today to give this informational session on Engineers and Architects Day at the Capitol. And I was happy to see many architects and engineers out in the audience.
My name is Jay Raskin. I'm the vice chair of OSPAC. I'm here replacing Jay Wilson, who is both the chair of OSPAC and also a member of the Oregon Resilience Task Force.
Thank you.
So this task force was a follow-up to the Oregon Resilience Plan. It was a volunteer effort of well over 100 people that came up with many recommendations on what we need to do to be more resilient here in Oregon with the Cascadia subduction zone lurking off our shores. Our task force was in existence for a year, and what our task was is to really go through all those recommendations and come out really with what are the top priorities for this legislative session. The members of the task force, you can see here that it included Jeff Rubin, my vice chair, along with Representative Boone, Mark Salsworth, Mayor Endicott, Dave Fair, Mike Harriman, Commissioner Mark Labhart, Heidi Moab, Lucinda Moore, Paula Nageli, Senator Olson, Senator Roblin, Jeff Slodges from Industry, Dave Stuckey, Representative Widmer, and Jay Wilson. We had broad representation from across the state as well as public and private sector. The reason that we are here today is this Cascadia subduction zone. It is a subduction zone set of plates that is similar to what we see in earthquakes down in Chile and that devastating magnitude 9.0 earthquake that we saw in Japan in 2011. This is a subduction zone that lurks off the Oregon coast, but some of the fault rupture surface goes underneath the state of Oregon, stretches from Northern California up into British Columbia. And if you look at the figure on the right, typically in these things, red is bad, green is good, and I think in this case, this type of earthquake, a magnitude 8.5 or 9 along the Cascadia subduction zone, is something that will be felt all the way to Salt Lake City. It is going to cause damage and have an impact throughout the Pacific Northwest, particularly in Central Oregon, the Willamette Valley, and especially the Coast Range. Just to give you an idea of the impact that we're looking at, this is from our Oregon Resilience Plan, the document you see on the right. For the Willamette Valley, what our current estimates are for our current state of affairs is that in the Willamette Valley, we'd be out of electricity for 1 to 3 months. Police and fire stations would be out of commission for 2 to 4 months. Top priority highways would be out of commission for 6 to 12 months. And that's really just restoring partial service, not full service. Healthcare facilities, 18 months. Water and wastewater facilities, 1 month to 1 year. Over in Central Oregon, they do better. It's not this bad. And along the coast, much of the results are really devastating, much longer outages than what we see here. And these efforts are coming from the public utilities, from ODOT, from representatives from our emergency services. These are the people that are actually living this and making our preparations. Just to give you some examples from recent earthquakes around the Pacific Rim on what this means, our mobility will be severely impacted. Our ability to provide rescue and relief efforts will be impacted by the loss of bridges, by the closure of all of the highways over to the coast, by the closure of most of Highway 101, and many parts of Interstate 5. We are also extremely susceptible to liquid fuel shortages. All of our liquid fuel, that's gasoline, diesel, air fuel, all comes in across the Willamette River, the Columbia River, into one hub in Northwest Portland that is an area of high liquefaction and lateral spreading potential. If and when we lose that in the course of the earthquake, Oregon currently has no backup supply other than trucking things in, and the trucking in will be along Highway 97 because much of I-5 will be out of commission. This is a figure out of Chile. We have, if you look at Chile, they have 8.5 to 9 magnitude earthquakes on the average about every 15 years. So you really don't have to, at least in Chile, much of the weak stuff is already gone. All right, and they still yet have damage, and this is a magnitude 8.8 earthquake back in 2010. In Oregon, we have a large inventory of what we call legacy infrastructure. These are bridges, substations, buildings that were built back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, actually through the 1970s before we understood the risk from this Cascadia subduction zone. So one of our risk in Oregon is unique because we are stuck with these legacy systems. And an opportunity for us is to try to find a way to invest wisely to retrofit the stuff that we are stuck with today. Drinking water is critical. This is in the city of Concepcion, Chile, after their 2010 earthquake. The military had to be called in to restore order in this second largest city in the country of Chile. Most of the population was without drinking water. And if you combine that with the impact on our highway system, our mobility, we have to be able to get drinking water to the people, and we only have a few days to do that. And then here in Oregon, like many, many locations around the Pacific Rim, we have this double whammy or this double threat where we have 3 to 5 minutes of strong shaking followed by a tsunami maybe 20 minutes later. And the results of a tsunami can be devastating. This is a photo from the one in Japan. This is from one in Chile. And this is a region in Japan where the tsunami struck, where they lost nearly 20,000 lives. This was a set of homes. And you see the kind of the little concrete strips. Those are the walls between the different homes for this area. And now the city of country of Japan is now deciding how to rebuild these areas. How do you put these communities back together now that they've been torn apart? We also have to think about the economy and how businesses are prepared. It may be that we have a structure that is reusable after the earthquake, but then when you look at the contents and the businesses lose their files, their computers get broken, the ceiling tiles fall down, you can put a business out of business just because they have lost this business continuity. There's an example in Christchurch, New Zealand, where there was a building that suffered relatively minor structural damage. But the inside of the building was closed for 12 months to repair the architectural stuff and for the businesses to try to get their act back together. And if you don't get business, if people don't have jobs, it makes it very difficult to recover and to bounce back after an earthquake. These are homes. This is outside of Christchurch, New Zealand. In that city of about 500,000 people, 80,000 homes were damaged in this earthquake. Many of them, because of difficulties in settling with the insurers, are still essentially left abandoned. I had the opportunity to revisit Christchurch 3 years after their earthquake, and you could just feel it in the community that they had not bounced back. Their central business district was still closed after 3 years. And so what we're trying to do is trying to improve the resilience of Oregon, to try to improve our ability to bounce back after a seismic event. And if you look at Japan, if you look at Chile, of course we're going to take a hit, particularly to our lifeline services, the things we depend on every day, our electricity, natural gas, our transportation, telecommunications. But after these earthquakes, because they have a resilient state ahead of time, they're able to bounce back and actually improve service after the earthquake. Where we are in Oregon with this unique risk, where we are stuck with these legacy systems and really a lack of preparation for the decades that other people have been working on it, I am concerned, and I think much of the community is concerned, that we can't bounce back. And one of the things we learned from these earthquakes is that if you lose businesses, if they go somewhere else, it's very difficult to get that business to move back because they've already become established. If you look at the Port of Kobe in Japan, they lost temporarily 90% of their port facilities. Now, they were able to rebuild them, but they lost permanently 30% of their business just because they went somewhere else and set up operations. So what are the objective of our task force was to take the over 140 recommendations that were in this Oregon Resilience Plan that really had varying level degrees of specificity and to narrow it down to what are the most important actions that we need to take in this upcoming legislative session. It's acknowledged that we're not going to do everything in the next 2 years, but I think it's critical that we begin. Right, and that we start, because many of these efforts will take decades, really, to get us to a point of resilience. We have recommendations in 8 specific areas, and what I'd like to do is go through our 8 areas and briefly describe our recommendations to you, and then have Jay follow up on the mission of OSPAC and the importance of what we're trying to do, and then answer any questions that you might have. Our overwhelming number one recommendation is that a resilience policy advisor be appointed by the governor and that they report directly to the governor. Our task force, the Oregon Resilience Plan, efforts before that have all been volunteer efforts. We believe that it is time to put somebody in the state government that actually is responsible for resilience. This was our number one recommendation. We highly recommend that it is in the governor's office and not within one of the agencies, because I think one of the feedback we got from our agency friends is that having one agency try to direct what's going on in the other agency really just doesn't work that well. For transportation, what we are recommending is that we find revenue to support the most critical backbone routes identified by ODOT's Seismic Options Report. This is a core lifeline route that targets Highway 97 as the main north-south route through the state of Oregon in the event of a Cascadia earthquake. Comes along Interstate 84 and 205 down the I-5 corridor and then back over to 58. But this lifeline route allows us to move goods and services as part of our rescue, relief, and recovery efforts. We're not saying that we have to fix that entire lifeline route in the next 2 years. What we're saying is that we need to identify a source of funds, not bonds, but some other source of funds to pay as we go. We're also recommending that we do a thorough and complete assessment of our transit and our airports, water ports, and rail assets, because this is really a multimodal solution after the earthquake. It's not just cars. It's taking advantage of our cars, trains, our airports, et cetera. Just to give you the example, the blue route that you see here in this ODOT map is that core lifeline route. Once we get that core route down, we start expanding out to get lifelines out to the coast, and we start working along the coast. Current state of affairs, based on the ODOT, on a recent ODOT report, is that all of 101 will be shut down from bridge failures. All the routes to the coast would be shut down from bridge failures. And as a geotechnical engineer, I can tell you they'll also be shut down from landslides, and that parts of I-5 would be open, right? This will severely impact our mobility after the earthquake. For land use recommendations, we're recommending that the L line be adopted for the most recent tsunami hazard maps. This is the large earthquake. It's kind of in the middle of, we don't necessarily plan for the 9, we don't plan for an 8, but we look at what the most likely earthquake is, and this is what we refer to as this L line. We recommend that local governments not necessarily wait for the state, and let's adopt this latest version of the tsunami hazard maps now in their current planning. We recommend that new funding of $5 million be made available by the state through existing programs for resilience planning by the coastal communities that are at most risk, severe risk during the tsunami. We also want to revise Oregon Reserve rules to make them more useful for recovery planning prior to a tsunami. Allow for pre-disaster urban growth boundary revisions for safer development, and facilitate recovery by expediting post-disaster urban growth boundary modification. What we find in the recovery from earthquakes is that when you in the wake of the disaster, if that's not the time to start planning on what to do next. What we're encouraging communities to do is take the action now. When the tsunami hits, how do you plan to rebuild your communities? For energy recommendations, what we're recommending is really a coupled approach. One, we recommend that the PUC require energy providers it regulates to conduct seismic assessments of its regulated facilities. The energy providers requested the PUC be the ones to provide oversight, so they're not working with another agency. They also requested that the utilities be allowed to recover the costs of these seismic improvements through the rate base. So please regulate them and let them recover those costs. The utilities are concerned about potential liability concerns for identifying hazards and not necessarily having them fixed yet. We spent quite a bit of time on that, discussed at the task force, got an opinion from the Attorney General, and it was inconclusive. I think the general consensus was that somebody that identifies a hazard in good faith and has a plan to fix it and yet doesn't get it fixed by the time the earthquake happens is in good shape. But I think that we're going to leave that to our friends at the table here. We also recommend to establish a public-private partnership to mitigate and evaluate a diversification of locations for storing liquid fuels and identify new liquid fuel energy corridors. We don't believe the best route for the state is to fix the one single hub that we have, though that's probably needed. What we recommend is that we want to diversify and make our system more flexible by finding an alternative source of liquid fuel coming into the state. If you look at our critical facilities, this is just gives you an idea of when our schools were built. Many of them back in the 50s and 60s. If you look at our fire stations and law enforcement stations back in the 70s, much of this before we were aware of this risk from the Cascadia earthquake. What we're recommending is that Dogami be funded for up to $20 million to update and enhance the statewide inventory and provide a preliminary evaluation of critical facilities, fire stations, police stations, schools, and that for the OBDD IFA Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, that be funded with an initial amount of $200 million in this next biennium. When we first passed those, approved the bonds to retrofit the schools, the professionals realized that was a $1 billion effort. And it's been coming out at, I believe, $20 million per biennium. $30 million per biennium. What we're saying is that we need to increase that by an order of magnitude and get that job done. We're also recommending that the demolition costs for unsafe buildings may be covered under seismic rehabilitation. What we're finding is that for critical facilities down in the inundation zone, that the cost of demolition is actually prohibitive for them replacing that structure somewhere else. And so this we're asking for this consideration. We're also looking at instead of retrofitting facilities, but dollars be used toward replacement of facilities to move out of the inundation zone, as opposed to solely moving back into the structure. And these may be these may require distinct companion programs to the SRGP, because there's some stuff regarding the SRGP program. For research, what we're recommending is that the state provide $1 million annually in matching funds for research targeted at trying to find the cost-effective ways to improve the resilience of the state of Oregon. We're looking at spending as a state over the next several decades several billion dollars. And we cannot really take advantage of all the research that's done for the smaller slip earthquakes that we see in California that are much shorter duration. And this unique problem we have with shaking a 3 to 5 minutes and with these legacy infrastructure systems makes our situation unique and something that we need to take leadership role on. Many of the private utilities, Portland General Electric, Northwest Natural Gas, EWEB, Port of Portland, ODOT, Bonneville Power Administration, Portland Water Bureau, Tualatin Valley Water District, all have seen this and have already started funding research on their own to try to pool together to see how we can become more resilient. And that effort so far is bringing in about $300,000 a year just from this one program. We also were specifically asked to comment on a formal center of excellence for resilience and research, and we figured it was not the right time to put a center of excellence at one university in the state of Oregon. We figured that it takes all of us working together to actually make this work. So at this time, we felt this was not the right time. For training and education, we recommend that at least $500,000 be funded to Oregon Emergency Management, really for helping train agencies, businesses, and the public. And I think something that really sticks out here is that we need to tell people to be ready to be on their own for 2 weeks. If you look at most of the disaster preparation literature, it calls for 72 hours. And it's going to take 72 hours for us to even begin to see what the damage is. And that's been my personal experience in the earthquakes that I've been in around the Pacific Rim. We're also recommending that $500,000 be made available to the Department of Education to lead a process in developing standardized educational content for K-12. And Business Oregon, in partnership with OEM, strongly encourages continuity assessments and planning for all businesses. And for water and wastewater, this is my last slide. What we recommend that our water providers and our wastewater providers do seismic assessments and include that in and make that a requirement for their periodic updates to their master plans. And I think for critical and what we've seen in past earthquakes is our ability to fight fire after an earthquake can be compromised because of loss of our water systems. And if you going back to the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, most of the loss of life there was from fire following earthquake. With that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Jay, and then we'll have a few minutes to answer your questions.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So So basically, I'm filling in for Jay Wilson, the chair of OSPAC, and my role and our role in this is basically to let you know what OSPAC has done and will be continuing to do. When OSPAC was formed, our mission was to improve public understanding of earthquake hazards, to reduce these hazards, and to mitigate possible effects of potentially damaging earthquakes. We're supposed to review and advise both the governor and the legislature concerning all plans and proposals addressing seismic hazards. Towards that end, after H.R. 3, presented by Representative Boone, basically OSPAC's role became to actually create an Oregon resilience plan, and which Scott alluded to earlier. We've seen the work that the task force has done, and we're extremely pleased with the results of it, and we're especially pleased to see that they also named their number one recommendation to basically to have a resilience policy advisor, which was our top recommendation. OSPAC is pledged to continue to support and engage the governor's office and the legislature for the next 25 bienniums. The Oregon Resilience Plan was a 50-year plan, so there's a lot of work to do. We also are trying to promote resilience across Oregon and right down to the community level. And we're actually having a connection with the National Disaster Resilience Framework. This is by NIST, the National Institute of Standards. And Jay Wilson is actually down there today basically helping with that effort in San Diego. They have a stakeholders meeting. Oh, I'm supposed to be doing it here, not
yeah.
There. Oh, okay. Okay. The National Disaster Resilience Framework is a critical part of the President's Climate Action Plan, but it's an all-hazards approach and includes earthquakes. And we're extremely pleased because OSPAC's plan, the Oregon Resilience Plan, is basically a reference tool for this organization, as is something called the Resilient City, which was something the city of San Francisco developed and we stole mercilessly from in order to do our plan. There. And basically, what is our expected disaster? Scott mentioned this is the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Basically, engineers define three levels of disasters for earthquakes. This is taken mostly for California, but they have the routine. This is basically an earthquake that happened, a 70% chance of an earthquake happening in the next 50 years. That's a routine. And usually they're about 5 to 5.5. Unlike California, Oregon actually has very few of these types of earthquakes, which is why we're not very prepared. The next design level for earthquakes is the expected earthquake. That's something that has a 10% chance in the next 50 years. And following that is what they consider the extreme, the maximum considered earthquake, and that's something that only has a 2% probability of happening in the next 50 years. The challenge for Oregon, however, is the fact that our expected earthquake and our extreme earthquake are one and the same thing. So taken as in conjunction with this disaster resilience framework that's being done nationwide, you can see in this chart that there's a bunch of different hazards: snow, rain, wind, earthquake, tsunami, flood, fire, and terrorism. And basically using those three categories, you can see basically the routine is 50 to 100 years, the expected is 300 to 500 years, and the extreme is, normally for earthquakes in California, a 2,500-year event. But again, this just is reinforcing the fact that our expected and our extreme events are basically in the 500-year time frame. This chart is basically, this slide was developed by Chris Goldfinger down at Oregon State. We've shown it to you, I think, before. That top, the timeline in the blue and white basically is a 10,000-year time frame. The red bars down below are basically individual earthquakes that we know about. There's about 41 of them. This means that this is the most well-documented earthquake fault zone in the world, which is quite remarkable because 25 years ago we didn't know anything about it. And basically you can see you are here, that's basically 2015, and it means that we are 315 years from the last one. So how did they actually happen? One is the diagram on the left is basically a map showing the full rupture, that red splotch from Northern California up to Southern British Columbia. These happen on the average every 500 years, and they usually give us a magnitude 9 earthquake. Occasionally, you see one that's basically Northern California and all of Oregon. They happen about every 480 years. That's an 8.5 to an 8.8 earthquake. As you go towards the right, there's two of them, Northern California and Southern Oregon. That's those recurrence intervals are 240 and 320 years. Yet even the smallest one is 7.6, and they still get up to an 8.5 magnitude earthquake. These are large, large events. So we also wanted to point out that what are the tools that we are that the state has for pursuing resilience expertise. And basically, those are based on Oregon revised statutes and Oregon administrative rules. These rules are the tools and that provide guidance and assistance to local governments and communities. They need to be up-to-date, current, and adaptable, or what we have is a risk of projects falling through the cracks. And the project that we want to make remind you of is the situation down in Gold Beach, a hospital, where they had one state agency basically saying they had to rebuild their hospital by 2016 because it had severe code issues. At the same time, Dogami was doing some excellent studies for tsunami inundation mapping and was saying actually that tsunami inundation line should be moving eastward. But they had a time frame. They also have severe economic difficulties. They've probably done the best solution they can do. It will be safer, but they basically now have a hospital that is still at risk to, not maybe to earthquakes, but is at risk to the tsunami. So we need to be moving this with certainty and to provide certainty to these communities to know what they should be doing. Jay Wilson had the opportunity this last year to go to visit Japan and see, kind of look at what happened after the earthquake and to get to see lessons learned. This is the Ishinomaki Red Cross Hospital. It was actually built before the hospital, before the earthquake. It survived. It was operational during the earthquake and is operational now. You can see on the lower right-hand corner, basically, that's the foundation, the dark metal steel frame. That's the foundation of that building. And those green pads, these green structures and the pads underneath are basically something called base isolation. Basically, that allowed this building to ride out the earthquake without any damage and to be fully functional. This is something that's not common in the United States. As far as I know, there's only one building in Oregon that has this, which is the Pioneer Courthouse. But it's probably something that we as a state need to really seriously consider for our hospitals and our essential facilities. It costs more money, but basically the issue here is how much does it cost not to do it? We need these things operational. They do it not only for hospitals, they do it for fire stations. This is an example of Tomei City in Miyagi Prefecture. You can see the facility up in the upper left. In the lower left is basically Jay Wilson, and he's down in the basement, so you can see behind him the base isolation. And on the right is a little diagram on the building, which basically the little diagram on the top shows that the building is moving independently of the ground. And because that's happening, they're giving you a warning not to try to get into the building while it's shaking because it's like getting off the end of an escalator. There's a little bit change in speed there. So we're here. We want to thank you for your consideration, and we're here for any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes, sir.
Senator Evans.
First of all, I want to thank you for all the hard work that you guys have been doing. I used to work for Governor Mongoski several years back when we were starting some of these things, and it's exciting to see how far you've come. I really have a couple of requests more than questions, things that I'd like you to maybe look into if you can and give me your perspective on if that's possible. But the first one has to do with the Center of Excellence piece. I get the point that we need to make sure that lots and lots of seeds are planted, so there's lots of blooms, but what is the plan or what do you recommend is the plan to make sure that we have at least some focus or some general direction for research rather than some unfocused expenditures? That's just one question. And the other one is, as you were looking at these models for the resiliency advisor and those protocols that would be necessary to be supportive, I ask you to review Executive Order 0820. It's been kind of lost by history, but it was created in the shadow of a major disaster we had along the coast. And it is not directly related to seismic, it's more all hazards, but there may be some tools in there that could be effective. The last piece really is more of a question as far as the isolated base technologies. I think Campbell Hall at Western Oregon University has some of that in it, when they refit it in the early 90s. It's not as good as Utah or some other places, but it was a state structure that we did something with, and there might be some lessons there for local review. Doug Yammy was involved with that refit, so that may be helpful. But I just wanted to, if you can, at your convenience, I'd appreciate the follow-up on it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Escobar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about 97. my memory serves me correct, if you have a 9.0 and if you have a 9.1, the 9.1 is 10 times greater than the 9? Is that the way that works, or is it a
40%, 40% more.
How much?
From 9.0 to 9.1, it's 40% more energy released by that earthquake.
So at 9.3, we're there,
right? 9.3, it goes up logarithmically, so...
But you'd go 40% plus 40%, plus 40%, right?
Probably not.
I'm going to let you take that one.
You can tell it's held in some math there.
It's, if you look at the amount of energy released in a magnitude, you know, if it's a 9 or 9.1 or 8.8, the best way that I've seen it described, and this was when I was down in Chile, is that it was a magnitude 8.8 earthquake, and the best way I saw it characterized, it was essentially, this was about 3 or 4 magnitude 7.5 earthquakes, one right after the other. So it's not necessarily that you get stronger and stronger shaking, but what we find is that the shaking goes on for 3 to 5 minutes, where if you look at the Loma Prieta earthquake, 1989 in the Bay Area, the shaking there was about 18 seconds. Mm-hmm. And so it's an eternity almost.
Now, we say we're going to utilize 97, and the only weak point I really see in 97 is the Crooked River Bridge. Would that sustain a 9.5 off our coast?
So if you look at Highway 97, if you look at Oregon's seismic options report, there is still work to do along Highway 97 to make that resilient in the case of a Cascadia event. And then kind of the way it'll work is that the shaking will get less and less as you go toward, you know, as you go toward the east. It'll be greatest along the coast, less or so in central Oregon, but there's still quite a bit of work to do there to get even Highway 97 up and to the level that we need it to be at.
Now, the other question, my last question is, we have, where Representative Boone lives, we have a real problem here. I mean, these people have a problem. What are we going to do to get to the people that are going to be isolated? Mm. That's real important to me, because these are our fellow Oregonians, and we must respond, and we must respond rapidly, because their infrastructure is going to be gone or tainted one way or the other, but probably gone with a magnitude of 9. So what do we have in place?
So, you know, if you look at the Oregon Resilience Plan, you look at how we reach the people on the coast. If you look at for the ODOT Seismic Options Report, one of the things we need to do is make sure that we have the routes to the coast open within 3 days. Not that they stay open immediately after the earthquake, but within 3 days, we're able to get to the coast. I think you also look at our recommendation that people, you know, you educate the people and you get people to be essentially to be on their own, or at least in their neighborhood and their community, be on their own for a couple of weeks, so that people take individual preparedness, their own responsibility. You also look at these critical facilities, the police, the fire stations, the hospitals, city halls, those facilities that you're going to need operational after the earthquake, that you move those over time outside of the inundation area. You know, we have a lot of homes, we have a lot of businesses that will thrive in the inundation area. We're not recommending that everybody move away from the coast, but for these critical facilities you need right after the earthquake and the tsunami, move those with time outside the inundation area.
Higher ground.
Yes.
I might just add that although I was basically the northern Oregon coast, that the southern Oregon coast probably is the most critical area. They're, as I showed on those series of slides, that they have a recurrence interval that's much shorter. They're at much greater risk. That there might actually be some consideration geographically that they get maybe in this planning get helped out a little bit first in this effort because their risk is higher. This is not something actually we've talked about very much, but I think that this is a good time to start talking about it.
I think the coast would be our first priority, and we'd move inland because the farther inland we go, the less the need is.
But you will need, you know, essentially Central Oregon will be a staging area to help the valley, and the coast, and so it's you really need to be working on all these efforts.
And I would add to that, there's the tough nut about basically liquid fuels, because it's all in Portland. And unless we solve that, basically nothing's going to happen.
Representative Boone?
Thank you. And just to ease your mind a little bit, Sal, thank you for thinking of me.
Well, I thought maybe you were saying you're looking at some property in Idaho.
Yeah. That's right. Actually, I live inland a little bit, and a lot of my friends are going to be coming to my place. But Scott and Jay are absolutely right. There's been a lot of work done on the coast in the neighborhood groups for getting resilient, getting prepared. Canopy chest caches, 55-gallon drums that you fill with supplies, and they turn them over every 6 months. And they have routes for tsunami evac, and they practice them, they drill. We passed laws throughout the time I've been here since in the legislature as a member since 2005. And we started then with Senator Berger on the Senate on our joint committee, passed some laws that included a lot of the stuff that we've been working on, including preparedness in those areas and what to do. And one of the things that you made me think about were, and we weren't just making it up, but we were talking about assessments of non-traditional transportation because we won't have the roads and stuff. And so people who have horses, loggers who have logging horses and logging equipment that can get around and on places that are not drivable, et cetera. Helicopters, planes, boats, all kinds of things, and ways to get stuff in and out and around, pack animals. So we'll be calling on a lot of it. But, you know, here we have it. I'm sorry I was late. I was in another committee ready to testify on a bill that was kind of connected on our 911 fund so they can't be swept.
Like,
here we go again. And for our emergency services. But they got delayed, and I got delayed. So I wanted to say that we have a room full of architects and engineers, and, you know, these are the people who are going to be the front liners getting up once things rebuilding starts. And to keep in mind that maybe we've mentioned a lot of money to be raised to do or to identify to put these recommendations, implement them into being. They all represent jobs, and all the construction jobs, all the planning, et cetera, design. And a lot of people in these sectors are already working on things like that. And my son is an engineer for a water district, and they've been working on it for several years now. And there are people in the room who are on these committees on the task force. And so they're permeating the building today. So you should feel very safe.
I know my community will be cut off from the east to the west because we have the viaduct going through the top of it, and that will probably go down.
Yeah, and that's exactly like we have Quartz Creek Bridge on Highway 26 to the coast. So people who have homes at the coast, when I heard colleagues some years ago say, what does this have to do with me? I said, well, it has more to do with your house in Cannon Beach or Nesquin or someplace down there. And then they started getting interested in it, and there was a lot of what can I do to help? So there, it's going to be awful. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But I'm always hopeful because, you know, people like Jay, he's actually could blame this whole thing on him. He and Ted Wolf brought it to me when he was mayor of Cannon Beach and said, you need to do something here. And, you know, you need to create a plan. We don't have a plan. So now we have a plan. And one of the things that we discovered in the plan, if you read the whole 170 pages of it, was that we really didn't flesh out one of the most glaring needs that we're going to have, and that's the people services. People are going to be experiencing trauma, PTSD, stuff like that. So there is another plan in effect that's just got a number today. I gave, well, it doesn't have a bill number yet, but I sent gave it to you, Jay. And this will create an Oregon Resilience Plan 2.0, if you will. And Representative Peluso wants to be on board, and Representative Reed, and he's been integral in a lot of this. So there are several people who have bills out in this session that are addressing these recommendations, and I think we're getting close to that time where we can assess all of them and assign them. And Dr. Ashford said we aren't going to do it all this week, you know. We can't, but it's where we want to be over the next 50 years, and hopefully we'll have that time to put it into place. And it'll just, we have a lot of practice on the coast anyway right now for being isolated for days on end. And so people are somewhat more resilient in some of these areas. And then we're going to depend on all the people to hunt and fish and keep us, grow gardens and things like that. So it'll be, it's an ongoing thing, and I appreciate all that, that you guys have done. And Jay has moved inland, by the way, so I think that there was something there besides your wife, I know. But there are people out there working on it, and it's Oregon State has just been amazing. You know, it all started for me with Chris Goldfinger, Dr. Goldfinger, and seafloor mapping and why we needed to do that. So anyway, it's, for me, this is great. I feel like a mom who's just sent her last kid out of the nest, and they're off and, you know, go fly away, do something.
Representative Evans, did you have something else?
Just a quick question. There's a number of bills that are coming through the committee in the next several weeks that, as Representative Boone talked about, are specifically on some of your priorities. There's some other bills that could assist in this. They're all hazard bills, for example. Mm-hmm. So if you and your committee by chance could keep a special eye the next couple of weeks toward the bills that come out, there are some, for example, local tools for funding, for matches, for partnerships, using state parks, for example, as a staging facility. Those types of options that could be multi-hazard, all hazard, that might be helpful in terms of the larger picture that your advice and counsel would be very helpful on. I just want to invite you for that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll do that.
And I just wanted to piggyback on what Representative Evans just said, and that's something that we like to keep in mind, too. These are built for the big earthquake and the tsunami and all that stuff, and they're worst of the worst. But in the meantime, we can do things like we did in Vernonia. The problems there were floods, and so they moved their infrastructure upriver, so to speak, or upland. And they have now a community center, a school, the health center's nearby. But, you know, they have all those things out of the flood zone, but that's going to be, they're all obviously seismically upgraded, too, at this, because of our building codes. So when we build upland, Seaside School District's trying to build their schools up out of the tsunami zone, too. And we'll have, I'm sure, city halls will be up there, and they'll have a big evac center, community center, whatever you want to call it, that can be used on a regular basis anyway, and will be, if we have another storm where people are isolated and out of their homes or have no power and stuff like that, they can go there. And Camp Rylea, the military has done a great job. They're going to be probably within the year 100% renewable energy sources from wave and solar and wind and whatever else you want to throw. But they're working on it, and they're getting there. And they will be a big provider of services for people when they're forced out of their homes, et cetera.
So I have a quick question. Is there a date? So I assume at this point, and I understand this is ongoing work, at this point we have in code the regulations, the rules of what standards to build to today versus years ago when we built. I mean, we've learned a lot more. So is there some date out there at which from that point forward we know public structures and or private structures, roads and things are being built to a standard that is best designed to withstand what we're talking about?
There's that date is 1994. That's when we changed the Oregon building codes, basically to meet the risk of a Cascadia earthquake.
Okay.
Having said that,
right,
it should be noted that codes are minimums.
Okay.
So there's usually this problem that people say, well, I'm designed to code,
yeah,
with the idea that maybe these things will be usable. And it's something that we have to kind of start getting used to, which is not to ask, is it built to code, but is it going to be there operationally after the earthquake? It's a different, two different questions.
Yeah, the code. If you design to the code, you are protecting life safety, but there's no expectation that you'll be able to use the building after the earthquake.
That's right.
Any further questions?
One more thing I would ask Jay to, you know, and you too, Scott, to flesh out, if you would, about the fuels and the fact that we have 4 days of fuel supply and where it is and the state it's in and what will happen to it and how that will affect things. Not to put you on the spot or anything, but
well,
it's critical.
You know, my friend Yumei Wong at Togami, she says the gas you have in your car today, you know, if the earthquake was today, what you have in your car is what you're going to have probably for a few weeks. And we do have only a few days' supply in the state of Oregon, and we really do not have another source.
I would add, when we were doing the Oregon Resilience Plan, we actually did this exercise where we got all the different sectors, the groups, the wastewater and water and roads and everything. We asked them, what's the most important? How are you independent? What do you need in order to start fixing things? And it was quite interesting because we thought at the beginning that every sector would say, well, we're the most important. You've got to have that to start. But what actually quickly devolved down to is everyone said, we need to have a way to get to it, so we need a road, and we need to have fuel to get in our trucks to get to the place to fix it.
Sure.
So really, if there's the two big things that come out of that are most important are transportation and fuel.
And
the roads, ODOT is making a big efforts forward. We have a plan and a direction to go. We just need funding. For fuels, it's a little more difficult because there's this liability that Scott mentioned actually is quite a roadblock. It is ambiguous, and we need some resolution for it so that actually we can get the liquid fuel people on board to actually really start seriously planning about how to retrofit or fix, you know, stabilize their existing structures and to get this secondary source of fuel stock someplace else.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time to come present to us. And the good news is for us is we're not the budget side of this. We're the policy side. But thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair, my luck, I'd be looking for a service station.
Okay, I'm going to close the informational meeting. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2210. So would you... Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2210 authorizes access to restricted areas at the discretion of the incident commander for broadcast media purposes as specified. Directs Office of Emergency Management to train and credential. There is no revenue impact and may have a fiscal impact. State is not yet issued.
Good, thank you. And I believe we have Representative Huffman and Representative Wilson here to introduce this.
Yes. Get it kicked off anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Huffman, State Rep for Hutz District 59. I live in the Dalles and represent a big chunk of North Central, East, and Central Oregon. Here today to introduce you to an important piece of emergency preparedness legislation, House Bill 2210, which is also known as the First Informer Bill. Pleasure for me to come before you and kind of kick this off because of my background, and I'm surrounded by a lot of folks that are still doing the job, but I spent 22 years managing and owning a radio station out of the Dalles, and so I kind of come with a unique perspective as to the need for this bill. So I'm going to be brief because we're going to have a lot of current expert testimony on what a first informer is and what the need for it is. But over the years of my experience, probably more times than I care to think about or count, I was having to figure out how to get from downtown the Dalles up to my transmitter site. My transmitter site was at 3,200 feet across the river up on top of the mountain. And we've got folks in the room that have transmitter sites at 8,600 feet. I think Randy said this morning he's got a transmitter site at 8,600 feet. You know, they're kind of remote and isolated, and there can be a lot of hazards between you and your transmitter site. But the transmitter site has some very important equipment to keep you on the air. keeping you on the air is the important thing. And getting me from downtown the Dalles up to my transmitter site if there's flooding or fires or something in between. And no offense to Paul Mather on the back row there from ODOT, but you know, if Paul were manning a roadblock, he knows me and he knows my need to get up to my transmitter site, and that probably wouldn't be a problem. However, Paul doesn't man every roadblock, and sometimes, you know, I don't know all the ODOT employees. I don't necessarily know all the new OSP recruits, and they don't know me. And so getting through a roadblock, through a somewhat hazardous area to get up to my transmitter site can be challenging. And I've had situations where I've had to call the OSP lieutenant and say, hey, can you call them off so I can get through, or, you know, call the ODOT director for the region and say, hey, can you help me get through because I got to get up and get on the air. The importance of remaining on the air during some type of a disaster is critical. I've had so many instances where listeners reached out to me after the flood of 96 or the fire back in the early 2000s that swept from Hood River basically on through into kind of south of central the Dalles area, and people would call me up later and say, you were my lifeline, you were feeding me information about where food supplies were and when we were going to be able to get out and where the fire was or where the floodwaters were and how they were receding and all this stuff. We were the lifeline to provide information, critical life-saving information, to our listeners. And in some of those situations, I had to make really challenging trips up to my transmitter site to get me back on the air. And so this bill is simple. It lays out a certification process for a first informer to be able to show some identification and show that they've been trained and they are capable of being able to go through that roadblock and get up to the transmitter site to take care of business. We've worked really hard with state agencies to make sure there's no fiscal on this, because as with other programs through the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, the bill for the training and certification is footed by the association and association members, and so we've tried to do everything we can to make sure that it doesn't put anything on state agencies. I'm not sure if Dave Stuckey is going to testify, but he has been in the room today, and we've been working with him. And OEM would be kind of an overseer certification part of the program, but broadcasters would be the ones to do the training and certification for the program. So thank you very much. Happy to answer questions, but I think they'll probably be answered with ensuing testimony.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Lively, and members of the committee. Carl Wilson, District 3 State Representative and broadcast station owner. I've been blessed to be in an incredible business for my entire work life. My radio companies will be 58 years old this year. Same place, same dial spot. It's been a delightful vocation. I began my experience with emergency broadcasting when I was 12 years old, when I went to the family station and I saw my dad doing point-to-point emergency broadcasting in the 1964 flood, where people were calling the radio station and saying, I'm on Fielder Lane and I'm about flooded out. Could you send somebody here? So my dad would go on the air and say, we've got somebody flooded on Fielder Lane. We need somebody who's got a tractor to head down that way to pick these folks up. That was long before we had any kind of emergency broadcasting network locally. And so that was my tooth-cutting experience on how this operation goes. And that is, we develop a keen sense of ownership in our communities, a keen sense of responsibility as broadcasters to our community. And I can think of nothing worse than being unable to get to one of our far-flung translators to restore service if someone keeps us from getting there. Because we truly are the lifeline to our communities, especially our rural communities. I've got a little keepsake in my office. It is a scroll, and when you unroll it, it is 60 feet from end to end. And it is covered with signatures and thanks of people in the Illinois Valley who are thanking us for being really on the job 24 hours a day for a number of days, during the biscuit fire that I think most of you remember well, that raged for so long. That kind of thing just reinforces within me the desire to serve my community and to do that by having equipment that operates or can be restored quickly if there is some kind of a problem. So I really thank you for taking a look at this bill. This really means everything to us because it allows us to continue the service to locales that we dearly love. And obviously people are very dependent on the information. So thank you for considering it today, and I'd appreciate your time.
Any members have any questions? Representative Boone.
I just want to say my name's on this bill, too, and my good colleagues, and I'm not going to go down and testify because there's so many more smarter people in the room. But I want to say that during the, well, both the 96 flood and the 2007 on the coast, it was the radio stations that carried the day. And unless you've been part of that whole sector and see how that goes, it's like police and fire. They're there all the time, 24/7, and they're, you know, you just, if you have electricity, that's one thing, but when you don't, there are other ways to get through, but they're absolutely right. And people were calling up police and fire and trying to find out, where do I go for the food, you know, where do I go for this and that, and then they put it on the radio, and that helped clear the 911 lines, so.
Thanks
for doing this, you guys.
Thank you.
Representative Escobar.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember the flood in 64. The radio stations were actually the guiding light for most of the population. We lost a complete mill up in Shady Cove. We lost a bridge. And Shady Cove is completely cut off from the rest of the world, except if they came clear down, I believe, to Gold Hill was the closest they could get across, which is substantially a long way to get around, but that was a very devastating flood. In fact, there was a picture. I woke up one night and I kept hearing this gurgling, and so I woke up and I'd look out the window and it looked okay to me, you know, I'd go back to sleep. Then I'd hear this gurgling, you know. So the next morning I wake up and there was a foot and a half of water going around our house. You know? So, that was a bad one. So I remember that. That was devastating to our area, and. It was something that I hope we never repeat, but I want to thank for what you guys did.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I should point out Oregon Association of Broadcasters is both radio and television, and we're regulated by the FCC. So a lot of federal mandates are put upon radio and television stations in the state, and a lot of those are related to emergencies. I was the lead emergency alert station for the Gorge and took that job very seriously for Hood River, Wasco County, and then across on the Washington side, Skamania and Klickitat counties, and went to a lot of emergency operations meetings to make sure that our communications were in place. But I was at the controls to pull the trigger if there was an emergency in the region. And so because of those mandates, I wanted to bring that in. I'm sure Bill, somebody will talk more about it, but you know, some of the mandates we have on us from a federal level are really key in this bill also, so that we can have access to our transmitter and stay on the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilson, I just want to say congratulations. For a person who's changed occupations hundreds of times, it's nice to hear somebody that's been so successful for that many years.
Thank you.
Okay. So next up, let's see, Ellen Miller. There's Ellen. Bill Johnston and Mike Everhart. Just give your name for the record before you speak, please.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I'm Ellen Miller with CFM Strategic Communications. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I'm here today with Bill Johnstone from the Oregon Association of Broadcasters and Mike Everhart, representing the Society of Broadcast Engineers, to talk to you about House Bill 2210.
Thank you.
So before we start, I really want to extend our appreciation to Representative Huffman. He's really been essential in helping us draft this language. He's also continues to be helpful in addressing stakeholder concerns. I have a little bit in my testimony about the Dash 1 amendment. We've been very open to meeting with stakeholders and addressing all of their concerns and making sure that this legislation is something that they can all be comfortable with. I also wanted to thank Director Stuckey. I don't know if he made it back in the room, for working with us and an OEM. He's been very helpful in getting this, crafting this legislation. So real briefly, I'm going to go over the provisions of House Bill 2210. I'm really here to talk about the legislation. Both Bill and Mike are really the ones that will talk about the importance of the legislation and also how the credentialing process will work. So the provisions in House Bill 2210, really, as Representative Huffman said, first of all, the intent is to keep broadcasters on the air during an emergency situation so that they can transmit the critical public safety information. As you know, and as they just discussed, it's an important part of our emergency response system here in Oregon. So the provisions in the bill is that it allows the credentialed broadcasters and broadcast engineers, and these credentialed broadcasters and broadcast engineers are what we're referring to as first informers, it allows them access to these geographical areas where there is an emergency so that they can not only repair and maintain their towers or their equipment, it could be their station that is in that geographical area. Another important thing I want to note is that it's also important that they gather information. So these first informers need to gather information and be able to transmit it. And it's something that the broadcasters, we really feel that you can't have one without the other. So we're working with stakeholders to tighten up maybe some language to make sure that it's not too far reaching, that it doesn't open up emergency lines to anyone with a cell phone and a blog spot. So we're really trying to focus that on broadcast and broadcast engineers who are credentialed as first informers. It also, an important provision to note also in the legislation as it's currently written is that it gives the incident commander the discretionary authority still at the site. So if there is a situation where it would increase the danger to the public for anyone to access it, the incident commander still has that authority on the site. So the provision of the incident commander combined with the criteria that we are working on to make sure that we're tightening up who is eligible for such a credential, the first informer credentialed, this is really addressing some stakeholder concerns that you might hear coming up in some testimony. So finally, there's a provision in the legislation that outlines a little bit of the credentialing plan. And as Representative Huffman mentioned, this is something that the Oregon Association of Broadcasters will be doing. They'll be doing the credentialing process and plan, and Bill Johnstone will speak on that. I want to mention real quick the Dash 1 amendment. I did notice that it got posted last minute. I understand if you didn't have time to read it. Sorry for the last minute. What we added in the Dash 1 amendment is we added that the Office of Emergency, the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, will be reviewing the credentialing plan annually. So that's how they will be involved in the credentialing process. Also in the amendment, we tried to better define the criteria for who qualifies for the credentialing plan. I am available for any questions. I'd like to hand it over to Bill and Mike first for their testimony, but again, I'm happy to answer any questions about the legislation or the process that we've gone through. So thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thanks, Ellen. And thank you, Chair Lively and Representative Huffman for carrying the bill for us, and Representative Boone for being our supporter on the bill. I am Bill Johnstone. I'm the President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, affectionately referred to as the OAB, so it's much shorter if you say it that way. I'm pleased to be here today to speak to you on behalf of our 200-plus members, radio and television stations across the state of Oregon, with deep sense of commitment for the well-being of all of our viewers and listeners as they present through me and through us House Bill 2210. Eight states recently adopted similar legislation. Those states are Arizona, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Nevada, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Virginia. and in doing so enabled their communities to be better prepared and protected from disastrous emergencies. But as you can see, these television stations are spread across the country, both radio and television, and working hand-in-hand with law enforcement and emergency personnel who have faced and will continue to face emergencies, some of which we haven't had the opportunity yet to have to face, but we do want to be prepared in that day should that happen. We've reviewed the legislation from all of these states very carefully, and we have taken from them the language and tried to take from them the language to build our bill that it would best fit all of the occasions we possibly can. To show how the credentialing provisions for House Bill 2210 would work, I believe we have submitted. Basically, it says this is how it works, and hopefully you have seen that. It summarizes how we would work to develop and share a list of credentialed personnel who go through a training program to gain status as a credentialed first and former broadcaster. Again, as Ellen, I would be happy to review the descriptions in more detail at your pleasure. And the provisions that we favor under House Bill 2210 would be added to ORS Chapter 401, which deals generally with emergency management and services. Let me turn this over to my colleague, Mike Eberhardt, who will talk more about the details.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee, Representative Huffman, for hearing this bill and our testimony. My name is Mike Eberhardt. I'm a broadcast engineer in the Portland area and a member of that chapter of the Society of Broadcast Engineers. This subject has been the issue of much discussion in our local chapter, more and more so with the information that's been coming out about the effect on our infrastructure of a Cascadia event. Oregon faces a number of natural threats that could render critical infrastructure inoperable, primarily earthquake, but also including the tsunami, volcanoes, and storms and flooding, as have been mentioned before. A number of critical infrastructure systems would be down for a length of time, as was revealed in the previous hearing. And what we found is that in previous events like this, there have been a number of lessons learned by broadcasters through the Hurricane Katrina and the Storm Sandy primarily, that broadcast radio and television are ideal communication methods for disaster recovery information dissemination to the public for a number of factors. But that we can't support that mission as broadcasters unless we can maintain access to our sites and also develop methods of communicating with the incident commanders and the authorities in charge to get that information out to the public. This proposed legislation addresses issues faced by broadcasters in recent widespread disaster events, as mentioned, for helping us to get access to our sites for restoration of service, refueling of generators, and gathering information for public distribution in support of response and recovery.
Great. Thank you very much. So questions of any members of this panel? You can let them off that easy, huh? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let's see. So next, I'll call on Michael Salvaggio and Bob Livingston, and then I'll call on Dave Stuckey after they've presented theirs.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, representing 1,700 law enforcement professionals in the state of Oregon and growing. And I'd like to say that we understand very deeply the motivations behind the bill to provide for access to broadcasting equipment and facilities, and we agree 100% with Representative Huffman and Representative Wilson's assertions about the vitality of getting and staying on the air. We do believe that it's vital to do so, to broadcast services during emergency situations. We do feel, though, that the current draft of 2210 is a little bit broad in places, and I just wanted to get these concerns on the record. And I think, as Ms. Miller noted, a lot of these that you'll hear are already being addressed, and we hope to get an accordance on this very shortly. just to, for the record, ORCOPS would like to work on amendments that ensure that the bill specifically addresses the types of emergency situations and the types of access envisioned. We don't want to inadvertently, and I want to stress inadvertently, provide unnecessary or gratuitous access to dangerous situations, notwithstanding the discretion of incident commanders, which in these kinds of situations may be subject to confusion and miscommunication. The allowable duties of first informers broadly include gathering news, and so we wanted to make sure that there was an opportunity to focus more specifically on technical broadcast and transmission needs rather than just broad allowances for various purposes. We think the broad allowances possibly feed into some potential confusion on the scenes between private sector reporting and the work of emergency service agencies, public information officers. And I think that by tightening this up, there's going to be a much better way to both ensure that the public safety personnel are able to do their job and the broadcasters are able to do theirs. And we think that both jobs are vital. So we appreciate and sympathize with the intent. As Ms. Miller noted, we're working to tighten up, and we are very, very happy to be working to further align this bill to its intent because we do like the underlying concept. Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions for him? Okay.
Does the dash one make any difference?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have not had a chance to review the dash one amendments at this time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Rep Boone and Michael's right. We got the dash ones at about noon.
Yeah, it was.
I was pushing Mr. Conley, saying, can we get the dash one? So in all fairness, folks, we tried hard, but they haven't had a chance to really review them. So,
okay. Thank you. Mr. Livingston.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston, Legislative Director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and our position on the bill is one of neutrality. Some of the points that and concerns that we had with the bill have been well addressed, I think, by prior people that have testified. A couple of things that I think I could provide to this as a 20 plus year veteran in the fire service and a current member career firefighter, some of the things that I think are important to be in consideration of is that, one, this bill is broader than simply repairing broadcast information. It is going to allow on a 401, which is a governor declared declaration, so we're talking a pretty large incident, it will allow for better access for the broadcasting news. My experience working with the news is absolutely, I would agree 100% with the good representatives and the people prior. Absolutely, though professional broadcasters provide a vital job for us, not only in providing information on evacuation routes and all of those things, but getting information to the public. Those that are professional and that are credentialed work well with, in my experience, with public safety. And so that information has to be accurate, and I think those that are good at what they do that. So a couple of thoughts as you work this bill that I think should have some considerations of. One, ultimately, having experienced as an incident commander before, ultimately that incident commander is responsible for everyone's safety. While this bill would allow for, you know, a truck or a broadcasting individual to get into what we would refer to as a hot zone, ultimately it's the incident commander that has to make that decision. And one of the things, again, it goes back to the reputation and the experience of the broadcasting companies, but let me just give you an example of a large wildland fire and those things. It is not uncommon or even unheard of because of those dynamic and changing conditions where actually even fire service deployed resources that have had bad communications or a changing dynamics, they've actually had accidents or motor vehicle accidents and rollovers because of that. So one of the concerns that as we address this bill, allowing unfettered access without dissimilar to what happens right now, if there's a, you know, and certainly by this weather, there could be concerns for alarm this summer. When you have a large scale event that's declared emergency by the governor, resources come throughout the state, and many times federal resources. Those resources simply just don't show up and go to work. There's a structured process from an accountability standpoint, a safety standpoint that needs to be in place. And again, I think those details worked out and making sure that either promulgated in rules through OEM or through the process are important. And so I think, again, broadcasting and our professionals in the media are essential for us to be able to do our jobs not only safely, but more importantly, to make sure that what we're there for is to protect our communities needs to be done. Specifically to the Dash Ones, as I've reviewed them quickly, the only question that I would have is a new phenomena that I think we in the public safety resources are having to address on a daily basis, and that is, you know, with all due respect to the professionals that have the training and that we have rapports with, the reality of it today in the 21st century, anybody with a smartphone can potentially now be a broadcaster and to do those. And so I haven't looked a lot at the Dash 1 amendments, but if you look at line 3, and I'll read, who has received credentials under this section or is who employed by or acting pursuant to a contract under the direction of a broadcaster. I think the details of who that contractor is, that could be certainly somebody, they have a relationship with somebody that's a local blog person and an individual. Would that provide that person that may not have the experience with that? So I think defining what that is, and again, working with those people that are here wanting the bill, that are professionals, and finding that balance as somebody that has to manage emergency incidents as well as represent the firefighters and others that do these jobs. This is a good bill. I think it needs a little more work. We need to work out the details. And again, I want to emphasize that those professional broadcasters are really vital for us to help us do our jobs, which is ultimately the protection of the life, safety, and well-being of the citizens of Oregon. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
And I'll just point out in the I think it's Bob Johnstone's testimony. There's a page 2 that basically states what they would have to do, classes they would have to take in order to get an ID card and after successful completion of the courses, receive their certification and ID. They'd have to show these credentials. And they would have had to have these things, which includes the introduction to incident command system. And it's an entire course at the ICS. So I think there's a lot of stuff here that probably wasn't brought out, you know.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Boone, I understand that. It's also my understanding that, again, that is going to be handled by the broadcasters themselves. All I would suggest is that ultimately for those people that are the ultimate incident commanders, which are the people that I represent as well as our people in the law enforcement, there's probably a role for oversight from public safety officers. And while I certainly know that they'll do a great job providing that, again, I think the coordination of that, because it is so essential to life safety, including the life safety of those people that are going to be put in harm's way by these broadcast companies, that ultimately that's a responsibility that I would suggest there's a role either in the OEM or other people in public safety to make sure that is a well-vetted process.
Just a quick follow-up. I think Ellen said, too, that it would be the incident commander retains that role throughout. So you still have to go through you or whoever it is, the incident command system. I mean, am I right? Okay.
Representative Huffman, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Bob, you bring up some great points, and I don't, you know, I'm sure we're going to be able to work through them. One of the things on, you know, the blogger situation, and I know the jury is currently out on what is a news person or a true media person versus a modern-day internet blogger, and I'm not being derogatory toward anybody, but in this situation, it would be somebody that would have the credentialing that was trying to get to equipment, you know, to make sure that they could stay on the air. So I think part of that's going to be easy to work through because we can prove, you know, who should be up there. You know, in my personal situation, in my station, there would have been two of us that would have had the credentialing.
myself and my program director, Shannon. And then, of course, on a statewide, James Boyd on the front row there was my broadcast engineer for all those years. And he would have credentialing from a statewide perspective to access numerous transmitter sites and equipment locations where he does engineering throughout the state. So I think, you know, whether it be from cost, whether it be from just practicality, I think some of it, although it needs to be addressed, and I get it, I think part of it's going to be self-limiting. But, you know, some of the points Bob brings up are really true. I mean, unless you've lived in the world and done it, you know, the relationship we had with Carla, the relationship I had with Bob Palmer, the fire chief in the Dalles, you know, you know these folks. And it's not even so much them as much as, like I said earlier, maybe somebody that doesn't know me, that doesn't have enough, you know, they're the ODOT worker that's out manning a checkpoint to make sure that they're aware of what the credentialing is so that they can allow access.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I agree wholeheartedly with you, but again, all I would suggest in this process, there's an accountability issue, and I think as long as this bill addresses those things, so to use your example, you're at a roadblock and there's a person from ODOT. Again, for us, when we deploy resources, whether it's a small fire or a large fire, you simply just don't deploy and start going to work. There's a process that's involved because, in your example, one of the things that from a strategic standpoint, once you address life safety issues, you start looking at, especially on a large-scale incident, what are those value items that you have when you have a dynamic, large-scale incident? And I can assure you that those that have experience in managing large-scale incidents, those towers, those communication towers, because many times those towers just aren't have your access to it from a radio broadcasting standpoint. That's our lifeline too. So my point is again, couldn't agree with you more. All I'm suggesting is that again, to make sure we do a good job of accountability and providing for life safety, making sure all the players manage that through a incident unified command way of communication is really important, and I think that can be managed, and it's not our intent to make this a cumbersome bill, but a bill that works well, because all I'll leave you with is anecdotally, I don't want to see an incident commander that, you know, is unaware of something and then to find and discover that there was a tragedy that could have been avoided by some company that doesn't have the safety equipment or the knowledge of where they are and if we could have rescued those individuals if they do get in trouble.
Any further questions of this group? Okay, thank you both for testifying. Now I'll next call up Mr. Dave Stuckey. And I just remind the members of the committee, we have also testimony that Paul Mather has submitted. Mm-hmm. It's an OLIS for your...
I just read it. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. As of today, I have no longer direct responsibility for the Office of Emergency Management. We have a new director. He starts today. You'll see this committee will see him on Thursday on an orientation briefing that the chair is scheduled for OEM. And so I'm very pleased that we have someone on board that's going to be able to move forward. But in my capacity as the OEM director for the last couple of months, I have had the opportunity to be a part of and participate in some of these discussions with Representative Huffman and OAB. And I'd like to go back to the informational hearing that we just had on the Cascadia, and we talked about this debate between roads and energy. And as an old Army guy, from my standpoint, it always starts with communications. I mean, it matters not what road is working or not working or what place has gas or what doesn't have gas if we don't have communication and we can't communicate with our public and we can't communicate with our first responders. And as Bob mentioned just briefly or implied, many of those sites that we have located across this state, I mean, it's one easement. There's one location. There's one hill. That's where the broadcasters are at. That's where the first responders put their relay stations at. And so all that becomes critical infrastructure. And so it's very important to us. We believe this is an important bill. We're in support of this bill. And we'd certainly like to see this go into statute. As I stated, we have this long partnership with broadcasters, and for those that don't know, Oregon Office of Emergency Management has the responsibility of the EAS system, that ugly analog sound that comes across. I would like to say that it's the broadcasters that help push that, but it is a collaborative effort. And we want it to remain as a collaborative effort between the Office of Emergency Management and the broadcasters, whether it's OPB or the EAS stations that exist. It's a spider web network that's required among our state in order to make certain that we inform the public, and is very, very important to us as we move forward to both the digital system, where we're going to be able to analog and actually specify specific points on the ground for certain emergencies. This is important. FCC has mandated many things, and I'm not a broadcaster. I'm not a pro on this. Representative Huffman mentioned these requirements, but from the standpoint of what the FCC demands, both in decoding equipment and what we have to do in encoding and pushing this information forward on whatever hazard it happens to be, a downwind message, evacuation route, whatever that is, we have to be in collaboration with these broadcasters, and it's very, very important to us. We have what's called the State Emergency Communications Committee, and it's the chair is defined in by the FCC. In this particular case, the gentleman's name is Chris Ichabod, and he's out of Eugene, a KMGE. And so he sits on this committee along with OEM and a bunch of other broadcasters to make certain that this system works, that we're able to be a part of this. And this system ultimately works well up until the point we need to fix it. And this is really where this part, where this bill helps facilitate that component, being able to make certain that those engineers can get up into that ground. This is critical infrastructure from our standpoint, and it needs to be fixed. An example, I believe last summer we had the Onion fire down in Joe County. Critical infrastructure, there was a hill up there that had a whole bunch of other had radio antennas and all kinds of other things. It had to be sustained. It had to be known. Everyone, first responders, had to know. The wildland fire experts had to understand that what the threat was and make certain that it was actually secured. From our standpoint, this bill helps protect the sanctity of the incident commander. That person on the ground is in charge. They will always be in charge. Statute in the state of Oregon, the way emergency management systems works is the incident is owned by the locals. There's only three different types of incidences where the governor can take over an incident. Two or more counties affected, failed resources or failed to act or something like that. It is going to be extremely hard. Locals own this incident. They get to make certain that this is managed correctly. It's their discretion, and we believe that this bill covers that adequately. We also believe that it's tied to, as Bob mentioned earlier, this tied to the 401-165. It's this governor declaration. This is big bill, or this is big incidences. And so we think that also is very, very helpful. The last thing I would like to add, at the very beginning of this, it talks about the FCC codes. And didn't have a clue what they were until we went in and researched, but it does tie some of the definitions of first informer and what this person is to the FCC codes. And you may see that right up front with 73-1, 74, 76, and then also 78. And as radio broadcasters, it's AM/FM radios, it's multi-channel video cable people, and just general service relay station. We're not talking about the blogger with the smartphone here. We're talking about people, the technical experts that are going to be up there and make certain that transformer gets fixed so we can notify our citizens and our visitors. And so with that concludes my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Stuckey? No? Okay. Thank you very much for testifying. Committee will stand at ease for just a second. So what's the That's a little scary.
All right.
Okay, we'll come back in session. So I've had a request for some members to come back up and respond to some of the issues or questions raised. So I don't know who wants to come back. Just identify yourself again for the record. Thank you.
Chair Lively and the committee. I'm Bill Johnstone, president of the OAB, and actually Representative Boone pretty much answered, rebutted the question. The gentleman from the fire department, from the firefighters over here, had excellent points, but I do believe that as he looks through the dash one, he will see that that the credentialing, we don't, quite candidly, we don't want the irresponsible blogger up there any more than he does. And so the credentialing is very severe, and the stations have to sign off on it. The person who becomes the first informer has to take exams, have to pass the exam. The station, in fact, that the employee works for has to have an emergency plan well described, well explained. So there really aren't any loose ends here that we don't believe there are. Okay. So that's my testimony.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? Wishing to testify, I have nobody else on the list at this point. Okay. If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2210. Any further business today? We have the Dash 1 amendment has been posted, and we'll have more conversation before we bring it back to a work session. But,
okay. It's scary given Huffman that much authority.
Yes, Representative Boone, you
I'm glad it doesn't apply to me because I probably couldn't pass the test.
I think this is something that obviously came
at tests.
Up.
Yeah,
and I think it's important. And I know that Representative Huffman, when he started working on it, told me I think this will fit in. Representative Huffman, when he started working on it, told me.